The second side of the 12th session, August 7th, 2006. And we're just talking about how different cultures evoke different images of the gods. The primitive societies, the animals and spirits, whatever those spirits were in their minds, were the gods, or the protective forces, or the forces that, like an environment, like the weather, they had to appease the weather, the gods, or they had to impose something on it or pray to it. Interact with it, right? Mm-hmm. It's a way of interacting and developing a contract with your external world. The images of the gods of Greek mythology, their families, their sort of the individuation process has started to come in, where it's not forces, environmental forces, animal forces, weather, earth, fire, water forces. It is anthropomorphic. It is human beings, chemical bodies. And they are individuals interacting in family units. That's the effect of the writing phase, which individualizes humanity out of the tribal mishmash. So I would say the drama of the gods of the Greek era was that period just before the phonetic alphabet came in, and then there were no gods. There became one god under the unifying, homogenizing monomania of the phonetic alphabet,
mm-hmm.
which happened through... The Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So it became one god. So the primitive imagery of many gods, many spirits, many not even gods, just spirits and forces and animals, they had an ecological sense. It was a whole structural interplay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've retrieved that on a macro scale, where the governmental tetrad managers have to monitor huge media environments, which are like gods, and interact and respond to the ecology of them. Ecology being just the basic interplay of them all, which creates all kinds of discontinuities. Which is one aspect I want to mention about Terence McKenna, is that his wacky drug experiences, there was probably a discontinuous factor, non-narrative logic, I mean, very chaotic. That is actually the media diet we have. The more conscious you are of all the media happening around you, then you would become more aware of the discontinuity of the collective experience.
Mm-hmm.
We'd become aware that we were on a Terence McKenna trip, and the news broadcasters, the Katie Couric, the Oprah Winfrey's, the George Bush's, are little elves, you know, buzzing at us.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as the media gets smaller and smaller, and we get bigger and bigger as a side effect.
Mm-hmm.
Everything begins to look like a little goblin.
Yeah, we haven't named our media gods.
Oh, yes, we have. The gods are the Nielsen ratings, the polls.
Mm.
And it's real primitive because there's many entities that are in the polls. And they're. It's like McClone said that Egyptian society used to worry about Cleopatra's nose. They'd worry about the most intricate focal point in the pharaoh. And we do that now. We worry about Christopher Reeve's ability to recover from his paralysis. And then he didn't. Then we worry about his wife. And then we worry about, there's probably a million stories. That's the National Enquirer. There's the expression of our gods, National Enquirer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have different disciplines, different media sophistication. So, say, Mr. Friedman is a god in the world of economists. Einstein was a god in the world of physics. And that was an image in the media that Einstein was part of. If he didn't have radio, he wouldn't have known about Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he didn't have newspapers, he might have known about him slowly, a couple of generations later, just like, you know, like Shakespeare. Wasn't a big deal for 200 years. It had to be retrieved.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Low society, manuscript, early print society, nobody heard of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I guess we're talking about him being heard by other people in other cultures. I don't even know if he was known in London after a while.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where he was retrieved. Who retrieved him? Might have been someone in Europe. Okay. But that was a European Gutenberg galaxy effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was no longer a local phenomenon. So let's go to the next quote. which is going to go back to the instant replay, which we have on the previous page 17. We're still on page 19. Now we're going to the beginning, to the middle of the page, and I would have put this in here for a reason. We've been doing this happening, the interplay of cliches and archetypes, and total consciousness is the sum of all the cliches, of all the media or technology we put with. This quote we're going to read next obviously is going to have something to do with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I positioned it there. So this is from a essay called The Implications of Cultural Uniformity, published in 1975 for a book called, put out by Bowling Green University Popular Press. The book is called Superculture, American Popular Culture and Europe. So that is the source, context for this quote that Scott's going to read.
One of the conflicts of a progressive and rapidly changing world concerns the use of surrounding services which have been obsolesced by daily innovations and discoveries. A vast new industry has been born from this conflict, and it is named, quote, camp. And its motto is, quote, throw something lovely away today, help beautify junkyards, unquote. Despite the grotesque aspect of, quote, camp, the incessant revival of that...
No, despite the grotesque aspect of camp as the incessant revival.
As the incessant revival of that which has scarcely had a chance to register its appearance or existence, it has already been itself obsolesced by the popular technology of video replay. The instant replay, available mainly to the audiences of sporting events, offers, as it were, a meaning minus the experience, reversing Mr. Elliott's observation that, quote, we had the experience but missed the meaning, unquote. The instant replay is the meaning in that it is less concerned with the input of experience than with the process of perception. The instant replay, indeed, offers not just cognition, but recognition or recognition, and leads the mind to the world of pattern recognition, to the aftersight and foresight.
Right, now you see there's a lot in this quote. It reflects the phases of the instant replay tetrad. There's implication of the cliched archetype process. It doesn't use those words, but that's implied. And I'm going to read it again faster to get it a fuller, it's like speed reading. You'll be forced to get a general pattern from all the ideas in there. Then we'll go into the ideas. One of the conflicts of a progressive and rapidly changing world concerns the use of surrounding services which have been obsolesced by daily innovations and discoveries. A vast new industry has been born from this conflict, and its name is CAMP. And its motto is, throw something lovely away today, help beautify junkyards. Despite the grotesque aspect of CAMP as the incessant revival of that which has scarcely had a chance to register its appearance or existence, it has already been itself obsolesced by the popular technology of the video replay. The instant replay, available mainly to the audiences of sporting events, offers, as it were, the meaning minus the experience, reversing Mr. Elliott's observation that, quote, we had the experience but missed the meaning, unquote. The instant replay is the meaning, and that's in italics. Meaning is in italics. The instant replay is the meaning in that it is less concerned with the input of experience than with the process of perception. The instant replay, indeed, offers not just cognition but recognition and leads the mind to the world of pattern recognition, to aftersight and foresight. So that's a pretty good quote, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So the phrase, throw something lovely away today, help beautify junkyards, the world first heard of that phrase when McLuhan would say that when asked what a McLuhanism is. They asked him why he created his style of aphoristic statements that became part of the pop culture in the 60s. He says, there was a sign in a Toronto junkyard, you know, overlooking a Toronto junkyard, and it said, throw something lovely away today, help beautify junkyards. So that is what he's saying he's doing. When he wrote his works, he was throwing something lovely away. Now, the junkyard would be that the satellite went around the environment and turned all the previous environments into junk, or cliches, garbage. McLuhan called it the garbage apocalypse. So I just got an idea that the word camp, if you think of concentration camps, and then the satellite turns the whole planet into a concentration camp, it may be an embedded meaning of the popularity of the term camp. And camp was putting on a previous image that had been sort of made popular, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying at the beginning, one of the conflicts of a progressive and rapidly changing world concerns the use of surrounding services which have been obsolete by daily innovations and discoveries. So you have these immediately, all these Elvis Presley records. 1970, you get all these old Elvis Presley records. So people start camping up. They make money. They make an industry out of it by being an Elvis impersonator. They replay the recent past, and it hasn't even had much time spent becoming a past. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because there is so much turnover that what took a while to become the past, 100 years ago, only takes 10 years by the 60s. It's like people buying old Model Ts, right? So he's saying a new industry has come up, born of throwaways. In other words, garbage can be recycled, an old cliche can be recycled and become a new archetype. Archetype being a new sign of significance, an emotional investment, previous cultural values. So he says, one of the conflicts of a progressive and rapidly changing world concerns the use of surrounding services which have been obsolesced by daily innovations and discoveries. So you have new media come in, new things, and they can't totally take over because people have vested interests in older media, emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
A vast new industry has been born from this conflict, and its name is camp. And its motto is, throw something lovely away today, help beautify junkyards. So he doesn't say that here, but the whole world has become a junkyard under satellite conditions. Despite the grotesque aspect of camp as the incessant revival of that which has scarcely had a chance to register its appearance or existence, I remember when Keith Richards was busted for heroin in Toronto, and he had to go on a trial when I was living there in 77 in Toronto. The judge had never even heard of the Rolling Stone. He had no clue about rock music. You know what I mean? Now, let's imagine this judge. I don't know what he was, but let's say he was 70. So he was born in 1907. Let's say 60. So he was born in 1970. His life consisted of all the media before the 60s. That's one of the personality. He did not even was aware of youth culture. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Might have dimly perceived it. He certainly, like an Eskimo, can see 50 kinds of snow. We just see snow. He just saw youth doing loud music, but he didn't know the distinctions, 50 kinds of groups. So for him, the Stones, which are old hat by the 70s, for him, they haven't even established their existence yet, let alone become the past. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So that's what he's getting at here. He says, despite the grotesque aspect of camp as the incessant revival of that, which has scarcely had a chance to register its appearance or existence. And for a subculture, it's already past and exploitable as a replay.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that has already been, that whole process where camp was like a passing fad because it was to be obsolesced by the instant replay. So even the registering of self that wasn't even around long enough for it to register an existence and then was replayed, that whole process was obsolesced by the instant replay. See, because he says it has already been itself obsolesced by the popular technology of the video replay.
Right.
The instant replay, available mainly to the audiences of sporting events, offers, as it were, the meaning minus the experience. So Eliot said, in one of his poems probably, we had the experience but missed the meaning. But when you see an instant replay, you see what the event that's being replayed, you see the significance of it, the conclusion, the consequences, the meaning. You see that before you actually live the event.
Mm-hmm.
So things are backwards. So he says, it's the meaning minus the experience. So the instant replay is the meaning, in italics, in that it is less concerned with the input of experience than with the process of perception. So since you're having the meaning before the experience, then the input of experience is not relevant, and so then it becomes a process of perception. And this is a clue to how Finnegan's Wake is written, which has all the tenses mixed up all the time. Finnegan's Wake is describing the world of the instant replay. People are having the meaning before the experience, and then they're replaying that. And you'll have that weird grammar of a Finnegan's Wake sentence where the past, present, future tenses are all mixed up. Well, that's actually what people were going to experience. Finney's Wake is a good example of an artist laying out a pattern that would be not have any meaning for the people in the 30s when he wrote it. Early 40s, came out in 1939. But if you take an extra look and retrieve it in the 70s and 80s, it begins to make sense because it's actually what people experience if you look at what they're experiencing in the digital instant replay society. So it's a process of perception. And you know, in popular culture, more and more people use the technique of suspended judgment or being aware of process. They're like, in quotes, tolerant. They let things, people, they say, you're dramatizing, you're acting out a psychodrama. You hear that kind of talk all the time in Oprah Winfrey. The idea of life is a process. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You couldn't tell someone in the 19th century life was a process. Life was a definite goal, an important task, and a journey to somewhere, and you better do it the right way. Here, there's such a mixture of meaning and experience, and time is backwards, that the only phrase we can say is the process of perception, which is like tactility.
Mm-hmm.
Tactility is the thing that's processing the sensory percepts. So in the instant replay indeed offers not just cognition, but recognition, meaning. And recognition is knowing the meaning of the cognition or the context. So it's not just cognition, it's recognition, and leads the mind to the world of pattern recognition, to aftersight and foresight. Now, we're going to have a quote coming up here which shows the disservices of this new world of pattern recognition on the daily level.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want to say about this? Oh, it says to aftersight and foresight. So you're looking back and learning from the past, and you're able to predict the future. I can see in the confusion instant replay in the 70s, channeling would become a fad in effect, because it's a way of ritualizing foresight and aftersight, because when you're channeling, you're hearing dead people discuss the past, their own lives, right? So I just sort of crystallize on that. Aftersight and foresight is a product of the instant replay, and the retrieval was the old form of channeling, dead people coming in. And when you have the meaning before the experience, you're kind of dead, you know. You didn't live through the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the occult gets retrieved again with new significance.
Mm-hmm.
All within the knee-jerk reflex of...
Well, the channeling of dead people, that was more like the mediumship. The channeling that I witnessed in the 70s was not channeling dead people. It was channeling some macro-dimensional beings that were not, in some cases, had never even been people, much less dead people.
All right. Now, that would be a new variation of the traditional image of dead people, which are seances. I would say the macro... What'd you say? Macro?
Macro-dimensional beings.
Macro-dimensional
beings.
Macro-dimensional beings. Well, that'd be like gods.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be macro-dimensional because people are having, what we said earlier up on top of the page, demobilized consciousness, and therefore we have multimedia and multi-consciousness. So the god of that, the collective pattern, the icon, would be something that's discarnate, which happens in electric conditions, and it would involve different cultural memes or spiritual memes, and it would not have had a life, because you can't have a life when you have the meaning before the experience. So I can even take that idea or that experience you had and fit it into this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually an update of channeling. Instant replay created a new kind of evoked image.
Is this connected to the Bob aphorism that the effects precede the causes, or is that a separate issue?
No, that's McLuhan's phrase.
McLuhan's phrase, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's the key McLuhan phrase.
From what we're talking about right now, or is that what we're talking about right now?
Well, the effect of the instant replay is this meaning minus experience. It flips the Eliot statement, but the miming of this experience that preceded it would be Finnegan's Wake. So Finnegan's Wake is an example of the effects in book form before the causes. And the causes are the technology of instant replay creating that situation on the audience, in the society. So, I mean, that's Ezra Pound's idea. The artist is antennae of the race. The artist works out modalities. like McLuhan says, Wyndham Lewis, his painting style mimed the iconic outlines of TV content of the 50s. Did it 40 years before. And look at Surratt. The guy did the pointillist painting. McLuhan would point out that Surratt painted the pointed dots of a TV screen.
Yeah, before there were pixels.
Yeah. So the arts, arts and sciences are guides. As we get more sophisticated and move along the evolution of technology in the 20th century, we can see what McLuhan's talking about easier. And we can see how, yes, in retrospect, that's what his book, Through the Vanishing Point, is all about. He goes through, you know, thousands of years of art and poetry and shows how they mimed the conditions that were coming in that particular artist's period.
Mm.
It mimed the sensory particulars. Like Renaissance perspective comes in 1420, 1440, in that period. That's just before the printing press, which comes about 1450, Gutenberg's printing press. So then Gutenberg has to become a book environment, so you have that by 1490, 1500, 40 years later, and people are starting to develop a visual perspective. It was mimed by the Renaissance painters with their discovery of perspective before the book creates that effect collectively. Reading isolates the eye into looking into the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Enhances it, separates it from the other sensory involvement or process of perception.
Right.
So definitely, that's the main insight of McLuhan. The effects precede the causes.
So which came first, human consciousness being sculpted in some way such that it gave rise to technology, or technology sculpting human consciousness?
In Jack Sarfatti's UFO physics world, they have this idea that when we see UFOs, they're us from the future coming back to us, right? And then you have the back to the future kind of scenario where we go back in time and alter what we're doing. So the idea of the past, present, future all interacting now simultaneously is probably what I think of when you mention that. Now, say what you said again. That was some other angle I wanted to take on it.
You
asked the question.
Yeah, is human consciousness being shaped by forces which sculpt it in such a way that it then produces the technology, or is it being sculpted by the technology? And if the effects precede the causes, see, I think that, I keep thinking that consciousness is being sculpted by the technological landscape, but if artists give rise to the perception of technologies that haven't even become invented yet, or much less environmental, then which came first?
Okay, I have in my Up the Orphic Anti essay, this statement that once you see the cycle of evolution of technology, that when you see that they will extend our original body and psychic internal faculties, then you know the pattern that technology will follow. So whatever made our bodies set it up, then our bodies started to extend themselves, and you're going to extend the ear first, then the eye, then the muscles and the kinetic, and then the interior landscape, the central nervous system, the tactile.
It sort of had to happen in that order?
Yeah, well, it didn't have to happen, but it will eventually happen.
Mm-hmm.
If society survives.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the poetic perception. The left hemisphere idea on McLuhan's chart, he has the left hemisphere, one of the characteristics is significant chronological activity or significant sequential pattern. You look at back at this perspective of the 20th century, 21st century, at the way, if you accept the notion that media mime our body senses, it unfolded pretty robotically.
Mm-hmm.
And so the effects were in the designer, and then the designer in created the body, which mirrored those effects, and then technology acted out those effects.
Hmm.
That's one way to look at this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a chicken and egg question.
Right. This sort of gets into the Thompson quadrant, but the theosophists talk about the rain cloud of unknowable things, in which they say that all these technologies and so on already existed and always did exist.
In the Akashic Records.
Yeah, and then they sort of rain down on us slowly, and we just you know, through the antenna of the artist, pick up on them and then bring them into 3D and physical
reality.
The artist
and the scientist, but that's an occult notion. I think that McLuhan updates that by pointing out that it isn't so strange if you think of the Akashic Records containing our technologies and all that was contained in our bodies. That's like a Catholic vision, bringing it back into the body, into this world, not some hyper-dimensional matrix, another world. Now, there may be another world, but it's a way of not romanticizing the Akashic Records and showing, localizing it in our senses, which is what Thomas Aquinas wrote. Aquinas, you know, big influence on McLuhan, he says that anything that's in its form is actually becoming its opposite form, eventually. So that's like the effects precede the causes. So that when I'm looking at the sun, it's actually becoming a moon. In the sense that this is like a simple tetrad. Anything that has a form is going to flip into its opposites. Day, all the time that we're involved in day, night is sneaking up on us. You know what I mean? And it's going to become night. And then while we're living in the night, it's sneaking up as day. So that law of form, that whatever is apparent, say figure, McLuhan would say, is hiding you from what is going to appear, which will be completely different. So it's a Thomistic idea almost. The effects precede the causes.
Well, it sounds to me with this notion, we could do away with the whole idea of spirit or even possibly God.
Well, who designed our bodies? What designed our bodies? But
yeah.
We could get rid of certain images of God, but then the mystery of consciousness of existence might evoke another kind of image, which you might not call God, but it would serve the same function of some kind of larger coherence or order. But we, as you look through the evolution of religion, as humans know more about what's happening in this world and understand why things happen, they have to change their image of the other that they're negotiating a contract with.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's partly right. Yeah, well, I mean, McLuhan said that Newton brought in an image of God, and then the 20th century brought in a post-Newtonian image of God, much like the radio. He thought the radio represented acoustic space. What is that phrase he uses? Centers everywhere, margins nowhere, boundaries nowhere, centers everywhere, boundaries nowhere. You know, it's a no margins.
Right.
Everybody's in the same spot.
Yeah.
And that's what happens when you're listening to radio. So the collective archetypal pattern changes with new media. And that's what I was saying, you know, half an hour ago about how the images of the gods are evoked by the media of communication that a society has.
Sure. Sounds like from what you're saying, though, that there always is the other.
Yeah, yeah.
There always is the other. So that means that there always is a sense of personal self. So,
and
but that's not
This is the communication point.
Yeah.
This is McKenna talking to the elves, talking to something.
Right.
Nothing exists in isolation.
Right.
It's always interacting with something else. And that's how you know. And nothing that's isolated has an existence. So it's interaction and relationship. And so that is a kind of communication. So there's always, what you were saying, is communication going on.
But previously we were identifying personal identity with visual space.
Yes.
But no, there's always a self and other, even when there's no visual space or before visual space arose.
Yeah, there was a self and other. There was a form of communication. So what was it? It was an amorphous mass of tribal consciousness interacting with nature and spirits. That was their dialogue.
Yeah.
So we look at the images. That's what the book Through the Vanishing Point does. It looks at the images of poetry and painting and culture and shows the shape of it and how it illustrated that ongoing dialogue in different images, different forms.
Yeah.
And the ongoing dialogue, McLuhan said, was a dialogue between the senses. In other words, when you had visual space in the Gutenberg era, the other senses are going to talk back and respond. And so you had a renaissance of hyper music. Mm. Beethoven, Bach, Mozart, all that stuff was a massage by Acoustic Space to counter the relieve the tension of the hyper visual space. So there's always a communication ecology going on among the senses and then among their extensions. So the 20th century is the most amazing structural ecology, because you've got all the senses interacting and talking via media environments, which are cliches. So a cliche is an act of consciousness. So if I read a book, that's an act of consciousness. If I drive a car, that's an act of consciousness. But if I want to have total consciousness, I have to sort of become aware of the sum of all the cliches of all the media technologies that are interacting with me and talking to me.
Well, that'll keep you busy.
Yeah. Well, you are busy. That's why everybody's so busy. They're under that pressure of responding to the conversation.
Yeah.
The media conversation. See, so then we come to the next sentence. The source is... I have here in the back, it's footnoted ZZ, and I have Marsh McLuhan whispered to me during a late-night telephone conversation in 1971... So that was a joke, because the quote is Camp. Camp is in quotation. So here's the sentence. You want to read it?
All right. Quote, Camp is popular because it gives people a sense of reality to see a replay of their lives.
When you have a world of the process of perception, of tactility, which is quicksand, very hard quark particles, very hard to stabilize in this instant communication going on, and translation. Communication is translation of one thing into another. Then people experience the archetypal intensity by just having a replay of their lives. And that's why camp is popular. And that's why it's necessary, even though the thing it's camping didn't even live for very long.
Yeah. Now, I always associate the idea of nostalgia with camp.
Yes. No, nostalgia is the biggest industry since World War II. One of the biggest industries. Tourism is nostalgia, mm-hmm. visiting the past. But nostalgia for the music era began in the late 60s with the replay of the 50s stuff. And then even the Rolling Stones and Beatles replayed the 50s music,
mm-hmm.
but in a new way. But the actual replaying of the 50s people became a big industry in the late 50s, early 60s. No, late 60s, early 70s and on. And then you have Star Trekies. You have everything. And it's totally natural.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of asserting the community you engaged in electrically, discarnately for a while by absorbing the same TV show.
Mm-hmm. But the instant replay is not camp. It's a little more, it's not nostalgia. It's not, it's
It's having the meaning before the experience. Camp is replaying the meaning,
mm-hmm.
replaying the experience as meaning, right? It gives the meaning, it gives people a sense of reality.
Right.
A sense of some kind of continuity. But with the instant replay, you have the meaning. So how would we be nostalgic about instant replay experience? Since it is giving you the nostalgia before the experience, if you think of nostalgia as meaning.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably why he italicizes it. The instant replay is the meaning in that it is less concerned with the input of experience than with the process of perception. The process of perception would be what I was saying a few minutes ago. You need to translate something into something else.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing exists in isolation. So the instant replay is a necessary manifestation of the fact things have to be replayed. Remember, I defined instant replay as the nature of any medium. Aside from it just being the instant replay of the 70s that we know,
mm-hmm.
with our tape recorders and video machines, the technical meaning of it.
Right.
So I have here McLuhan. You look up where this, quote, camp is popular because it gives people a sense of reality to see a replay of their lives. You look it up, and Marshall whispered to me this during a late-night telephone conversation in 1971. The point is that I knew that quote from a poster of quotations that Nelson put together, built on George Sanderson's collection in Nova Scotia. And so I didn't know where originally he came from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably why I made up that reference, because I didn't know where it was said. I just know that it was accredited to McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
So then we come to the next sentence, which is more interesting stuff on, let's see, on the instant replay. And this is from that essay, again, The Implications of Cultural Uniformity, written in 1975, or published then, in a book called Superculture, American Popular Culture in Europe. And McLuhan says what? Oh, and this is page 54 of that book. The previous quote from that book, that long one about Camp and Eliot and all that, was page 44. So what's this quote?
For America, the electronic revolution from industrial products and consumerism to information and custom-made services is a reversal of the entire way of life, with goals and directions suddenly yielding to roles and figures.
Figures in italics.
Mm-hmm. America has found the paths of industrial uniformity and continuity no longer to its taste. Living in a new environment of instant electric information has shifted American attention from specific goals to cognitive thrills of pattern recognition, a change that is manifested directly by the TV service of the instant replay. Is not the instant replay the externalizing of the cognitive principle itself? For the replay would seem to offer both cognition and recognition, the same pattern of reversal in the transition from the industrial to the electric age appears in the role of Sputnik, 1957, in placing the planet inside a man-made environment.
So this is a deep quote. I'm going to read it through fast. For America, the electronic revolution from industrial products and consumerism to information and custom-made services is a reversal of the entire way of life, with goals and directions suddenly yielding to roles and figures. America has found the paths of industrial uniformity and continuity no longer to its taste. Living in a new environment of instant electric information has shifted American attention from specific goals to the cognitive thrills of pattern recognition, a change that is manifested directly by the TV service of the instant replay. Is not the instant replay the externalizing of the cognitive principle itself? For the replay would seem to offer both cognition and recognition, or recognition. The same pattern of reversal in the transition from the industrial to the electric age appears in the role of Sputnik, 1957, in placing the planet inside a man-made environment. Now, I remember saying earlier, we need to always translate one thing into another thing, just like our senses are constantly translating their data into the other data of the other senses, which is, in general, is a process called tactility by McLuhan. This translation of one thing into another, he's saying, is so insistent that the instant replay is an expression of this need. So he's saying we're going from specific goals to the cognitive thrills of pattern recognition. We're overdoing the need for pattern recognition. But what can you do when you're in an information environment? So the need for pattern recognition led to the instant replay. There's the pressure. The effects precede the causes. The pressure of constantly translating everything, which our senses need. Once the media environment in the 60s of TV, movies, radio, and the whole global theater, it needed to be translated. So it was translated into the new medium of instant replay.
Mm-hmm.
You get it?
Yeah.
And so he says, we're going from industrial products and consumerism, uniform and continuous, to custom-made services. With the computer and the digital, you start to have things made for you. You know, an innovation in the 90s that's well into this custom-made phase, but was that Wired magazine would put out, even Rolling Stone used to do it, they'd put out different covers of the same issue.
Hmm.
So they wouldn't have uniformity. They had difference right in the periodical of that month.
So that they could target different markets, I guess.
Or just provide the sensation of change.
Hmm.
It's too hard to stay stuck in one position for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And, and it could be geared towards different kinds of customer preferences. But anyways, customizing is a cliche in our time. It's been developed, but that's the electronic service of giving you what you want as opposed to what your neighbor gets, whereas, you know, 80 years ago, everybody got the same thing because it was a limited industrial process of assembly line.
Yeah.
So we've moved from no longer desiring uniformity and continuity. That probably was expressed in extreme form in World War II. Everybody agreed that there was an enemy and went after it and enjoyed the uniform, right?
Mm-hmm.
And battled the other uniform. But living in a new environment of instant electric information, in other words, hyper-making, has shifted American attention from specific goals to just the cognitive thrill of knowing what's going on, turning on the news, going to a movie, reading the newspaper, checking out and having a sense of what is the iconic image of the flood, Niagara Falls of information that's going on 24/7, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the pressure of that, it was almost like people couldn't get the instant replay that their minds normally did. So they had to create an externalization of that process of cognition and recognition. That's instant replay.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to make a machinic version of it called the instant replay.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I guess, and he seems to make much out of the fact that it simply exists. I mean,
yeah,
the instant replay itself, literally or physically only, it was a very minor element of the mass media. I mean, you would see it in football games, and, you know, so in...
Yes, but sports became the biggest activity.
Mm-hmm.
What caused divorce in the 70s and 80s? Husbands stuck watching football.
Oh, Monday Night Football?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the unconscious attraction for sports was really the fact they had the instant replay. That was the drug that made sports dominant. I mean, Andy Warhol said in the 60s everybody wanted to be an artist, but in the 70s everybody wanted to be an athlete.
Mm.
That's an effect of the instant replay. It's puny if you're thinking of a little thing and thinking of sports, especially if you're not an athlete. But when you think of the mega power of television and the instant replay with sports, then it becomes a collective huge environment.
Sure.
Which you might overlook if you're not interested in sports.
It was a focal point of intense attention from the mass consciousness.
Yeah, and sport was kinetic. It was like, you could say it's like America, which is a kinetic-based society, relied on the dance and sports to communicate its essence to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so you talk about religious fundamentalism, you have sensory fundamentalism. And so sports became a big deal in America as America disappeared in the global theater. It hoiked up its basic sensory bias via sports.
Mm-hmm.
So he says there's a reversal here. The cognitive-recognitive pattern is reversed because you have the meaning before the experience. But he says this is a similar... All kinds of reversals happen in the electronic age. Another reversal is that Sputnik, a man-made environment, puts the whole earthly environment inside the man-made environment. Another version of the end of nature.
Well, let me tell you the way I think about that now, because that concept has always been difficult for me. The way I think about it now is that with Sputnik representing communication satellites orbiting the globe, this communication satellite is orbiting the Earth, therefore creating a matrix around the Earth. Which the Earth is inside of. The Earth is inside of the matrix. The first time I heard it, I thought, was he saying the Earth is inside this hunk of steel the size of a car with a bunch of circuitry? I don't see how you could talk about it in those terms. But you could say that the Earth is inside the effect of the satellite.
Right, but here's your first definition is right. It's just never been spelled out properly. It was Bucky Fuller who first said that with the satellite, and you put a man inside and or a woman, and they go outside, and they're living in a hostile environment, outer space, where a chemical body can't live, but he can survive inside this hunk of metal, then the hunk of metal has created an organic, livable environment, just like Earth is for humans.
Oh, okay.
That's the meaning of extending the planet as a habitable environment and putting it in another place where a human couldn't live, but now they can because they've simulated the Earth.
Sure. Or they've simulated whatever requirements the body needs in order to sustain life.
Yeah, and then they're able to get it out there and get it back
mm-hmm.
and survive that process. So, and that had not been spelled out to you before?
No.
Yeah, so now you get that idea, but also the idea of the effects of the satellite relaying information, which is affecting other media. All that is bigger than the planet.
Yeah.
For humans, anyways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a reversal.
The satellite probably does more than affects the other media. It subsumes the other media.
Right, and the idea that you got something going around us and potentially photographing us. That
the proscenium arch of Shakespeare's stage now extended into geosynchronous orbit.
Extended globally, where every person, 6 billion people, becomes an actor on a stage, at least subconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
And that could explain why, if we agree that 70s, 80s, 90s, or 80s, 90s became a hyper-celebrity culture, it's like everybody gradually, as this satellite effect from the late 50s became cliche, everybody knew they were in showbiz.
Yeah.
So they all said, well, that's what I do. I'll hyper my acting, because I'm already an actor.
Yeah, I'll tell you, man, me and my friends, we all got electric guitars, and, you know, we all imagined we were going to become rock stars, because that's what you were supposed to do.
Right, can you... It's supposed to do, you might think, in terms of peer pressure, but it was actually impressed upon you on the McClellan sense as an environment made you feel you were supposed to do that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's bigger than peer pressure.
Right, and what was I going to say? Did you play music?
Yeah.